In April 1945, on a sun-baked dirt road in semi-rural Cambodia, a rickety old steam bus bounced its handful of young passengers on a pilgrimage of sorts. The students from a recently built boarding school in Kampong Cham, which bore the name of a recently crowned king, the College Sihanouk, they were using an extended summer holidays to visit the grandiose remains of Cambodia's medieval golden age, Angkor. The summer of 1945 had been a time of great upheaval in Cambodia, and indeed the whole of Southeast Asia, as the Second World War approached something close to its end. The Japanese troops that the collaborationist Vichy French regime had allowed to be stationed across its colony, well, they enacted a quick and decisive coup de force, an action which effectively overnight removed the French from French Indochina. The boys, sitting on the steam bus eagerly awaiting their destination, represented a kind of microcosm for the larger change in the Cambodian political landscape that had come from this newfound independence. First of all, the extension to their summer holiday, this reprieve from the strict and disciplinarian French teachers who had been physically interned by the Japanese forces, well, this was all a direct result of that coup. So, just like their country, they were, for the time being, enjoying some freedom. Their usual lessons, all taught in French, as the boys were discouraged from speaking Khmer in the classroom, well, they had taken on a somewhat unintended effect, as the disproportion between lessons regarding the greatness of France compared to the underwhelming state of the French Empire was hard not to notice. Not only had the European state itself been practically absorbed by Nazi Germany, but its grasp on colonial territory like Indochina had been severely weakened. In fact, the very province that the boys were travelling into, around Siem Reap, had been lost to Cambodia's western neighbour in the Franco-Thai War of 1941. Cambodian nationalism would have its own summer holiday in 1945. The removal of the French and the subsequent defeat of Imperial Japan, this allowed the Khmer, who hadn't tasted an independent moment like this for the better part of a century, well, they could experience an unrestricted growth of nationalist sentiment, and for the effects of this political energy to entrench themselves within sections of that society. Fitting then that the close circle of friends that made up a kind of drama club, I guess we could say, at the College Sihanouk, well, they had decided to use their time over this extra school holiday to perform at a couple of towns around Kampong Cham to raise enough money to visit the medieval capital of Angkor, basically the physical embodiment of Cambodian nationalism. One of the students on this trip would later recall, quote, "When we had enough money, we rented a charcoal-powered steam bus and set off. It was 180 miles to Siem Reap, and it took us 2 weeks to get there, and another 2 weeks to get back. Every couple of miles a tire would burst, and each time that happened, we would all clap and shout for joy, because that meant we could get out and explore the villages. The village girls always received us warmly, because for them, college boys like us were really something else. Sometimes we spent the night at a peasant's house, but more often we slept under the bus. We spent 3 days in Siem Reap. It was tiny then, Just a few Chinese shops and nothing else. One night, we put on a performance to earn some money for the trip back. Most of the time we spent going around the temples. Angkor thrilled us. It took our breath away. This sounds like a classic summer holiday, right? It's got everything, a sense of independence, excitement, new places to explore, unexpected adventures, and girls too. And if that trip for the boys from the college Sihanouk had been a kind of coming-of-age film, especially the kind they used to make in the 80s and 90s, there's a good chance it would have had one of those endings, where they have a freeze frame on some of the main characters in the story, and they tell you where they ended up, like, oh, Wayne ended up pursuing his dream of being a banker. And if it's, you know, more of a comedy, it would have the class clown. Oh, Gus? Yeah, he ended up inventing a new kind of fragrance and became a fragrance billionaire. Or the president. Or something like that. You know, just before the credits or during them, even. And if we were going to make this film about this summer trip, this summer adventure, we could do a similar thing. We could do a freeze frame on a young man dressed as a traditional female dancer on stage, a crowd laughing and clapping him along, and we could have the caption say, Kyu Sampan went on to become a head of state in Democratic Kampuchea. He is currently on trial for crimes against humanity, genocide, and grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions. And then it could pan over to the fun, loving character that we all grew to love in the movie we just watched. He's operating the curtain ropes while his friend is on stage, and he's got a big smile on his face. And the caption for him would read, Salot Sar, or Pol Pot, went on to become the leader of the Khmer Rouge, widely considered responsible for the deaths of 1 in 4 Cambodians in the late 1970s. And in this freeze frame, standing next to him, standing next to Sar, was the boy who was his best friend throughout the movie. And the caption would read, Lon Non would end up being promoted several times due to his brother Lon Nol becoming Prime Minister of Cambodia in 1970. He would be one of the first officials of the Khmer Republic to be murdered by the victorious Khmer Rouge as they conquered Phnom Penh and all of Cambodia in 1975. This perhaps as the screen fades to black on a shot of Sar and his best friend Lon Non laughing with each other. Sometimes you get these small world vibes when you study Cambodian history. We've already noted many instances of paths crisscrossing over our story so far, and Kyu Sampan going on a school drama class holiday with Pol Pot one summer when they were kids. That won't be the last. The boys performing playful comic sketches in rural towns, trying to chat up village girls, sleeping under a bus and enjoying their summer, they were now 30 years away from bringing one of the world's most radical revolutions to fruition. And their paths toward that terrible destination are going to begin taking shape. How much influence can we say this trip may have had on them? Well, Sampan himself tells of an earlier experience that may illuminate that answer. Recalling how his teacher had taught the class about the glories of Angkor. Quote, I can still remember it. How terribly disappointed I felt when he told us that after the 13th century, Angkor had collapsed. one must never underestimate the effect of these centuries of decline on our national subconscious. It's why young Cambodians still ask themselves, almost instinctively, whether Cambodia as a nation can survive. End quote. Would he or Salot Sar had contemplated these almost existential questions upon their visit to the old city of the Devaraja? Would they have felt optimistic about the future of their newly proclaimed, if however short-lived, independent country, or feared that decline was sure to continue? This summer of 45 was going to be highly formative for both Cambodia and many Cambodians. And just like the students returning from their trip and eventually heading back to school once their holidays conclude, so too will Cambodia's brief independence end as the French return to claim their possession in Indochina once more. But the lessons and experience of this period will not dissolve as promptly as the returning colonists would hope. And it will end in a messy, costly, and tragic war. Hello there, and welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia, the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian Nightmare. My name's Lachlan Peters, and in this episode we're going to dive into an extremely important period of Cambodian history. Last time out, as was briefly alluded to in that summer of 45 introduction there, we had explained another crucial part of the story. The Second World War and its associated impact in the region of Southeast Asia. We left off at the tail end of 1945, with the briefly independent Cambodia under King Sihanouk and nationalist hero Prime Minister Son Yat-Thanh being signed over back to the French. Thanh being arrested in that process. This episode will pick up from where we left off, spanning the period between the end of the Second World War and approaching the middle of the First Indochina War in the early 1950s. We are going to discuss the birth of Cambodian politics, the rise of Cambodian anti-colonial movements like the Khmer Issarak, as well as developments in the lives of those who will go on to become leaders of the Khmer Rouge. So from magical warlords in the mountains outside Siem Reap, through to the student study sessions of Cambodia's educated elite in Paris. It's a lot, but as I said in the intro there, we are about 30 years out from the fall of Phnom Penh, so things are going to begin developing very quickly. I'd hoped to be able to chart a course from the end of the Second World War through to the end of the First Indochina War in one episode, but that's just way too much to get through. There are developments at every scale of our story here. Cambodian-level stuff with political movements and factors, Indochina-wide developments, international relations stuff, as well as the actual lives of important characters like Sihanouk, Salot Sar, etc. So this is part one. More focused on Cambodia and the characters, part two will continue that, but also fill in more details about Vietnam in particular and the wider context, which is leading us into the Cold War. Before we get started, once again, a big thank you to the show's Patreon supporters and those who have donated via PayPal. It is a huge help and something that I'm extremely grateful for. For more information, feel free to visit the website www.shadowsofutopia.com or follow me on Twitter. Lastly, if you are listening on a platform that has a rating or review function and would like to help the show grow, please leave a rating or a review as well. Much appreciated if you do that. I love reading those. It's great. That about does it for the intro. I hope you enjoy part one of Pol Pot in Paris. So I've struggled over a few drafts for this episode to find the best place to start. Following on from those absolutely wild months at the end of 1945 is difficult because from whatever angle you look at, basically everything has changed. An imaginary core sample of history here has this thick, dense, black line. Basically from August 1945, and everything looks different after that point. And that is probably literally true as well, not just a handy metaphor. I'm fairly certain any actual core sampling of our planet would reflect in some measure the use of atomic weapons and represent a drastic change for the potential survival of our species from that point onward. But for our story, we also have the emergence of the two new superpowers after the war, this bipolar system that international relations moves into. So that's kind of where I found the difficulty, trying to choose which scale to start at, in an attempt to just set up where everything is at. Like, something as large as international relations has changed. But so has the politics of the states we are interested in, and so have the lives of the people who will affect our story. In this historical hurricane that I've been harping on about, we have effects as big as, I don't know, El Niño beginning to take shape, but also that old adage, like the flap of a butterfly's wings, yada yada yada. Should I start with the grades that Pol Pot gets in 1947, or with the Potsdam Conference of 1945. One listener recently described me as being addicted to context, which is a label that I kind of love, but for someone who is a contextaholic, I guess we could say, this part of the episode had me grinding my teeth. I think the best place to start that will give us a medium dose of context is with the French. Their aims after the Second World War give us a window kind of into both scales, and an effect on each as well, the small and the large. So France and the region formerly known as French Indochina. In 1945, this situation looks something similar to an abusive husband returning from jail to the family home. He's brandishing a marriage certificate as if it were a proof of ownership to a wife, or let's say wives in this example, to include the various parts of the former colony. And he's saying, "Look, I'm back, and if you don't like it, that's too bad," as he dumps his bag of belongings on the floor. And like many people that might fit that bill in some way, they also wouldn't consider themselves abusive. If anything, they might think that the way they treat others is for their benefit. But there had been changes since France was in jail. that same kind of abuse was no longer going to work quite as much, and the power they think they have is simply not there anymore. The biggest change they're coming home to, if we put it like that, as we saw in the last episode, was in Vietnam. I mean, even that word is kind of important. A new nation state comprising the three territories that France had designated Cochin China, Annam, and Tonkin. Well, they were now all part of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, as declared by Ho Chi Minh. As Christopher Gosha notes in his excellent History of Vietnam, quote, two new nation states and two new nationalist leaders had thus emerged from the Second World War. The French Republic under de Gaulle and the Vietnamese one under Ho. Both men had real charisma and both held opposing yet strong feelings about the future of this Asian territory. This was a dangerous mix. End quote. Charles de Gaulle, the guy who was getting France back on track after the Vichy era, he and other senior members that were steering policy at this time had no interest in the kinds of commonwealth that Britain was setting up with its empire. Instead, they envisioned something called colonial federalism as the system they were going to employ. The French, as we've kind of seen throughout the series, were not very fond of having any dialogue with the native populations living in these lands. They don't ask what they think would work best going forward. The French thought that a pentagonal Indo-Chinese federation that would clump together Laos, Cambodia, Tonkin, Annam, and Cochin China would be the way to go, incorporating these into the larger French Union. This structure would afford all the states within it marginally more autonomy, as they would each have their own governments, but the French would remain in charge economically, diplomatically, and militarily. In essence, they would all still be French. This is the abusive husband coming back saying, "No, no, I'm a changed man. Things will be different." But they inevitably are not. There was also no signal of intent from the French authorities to actually merge the three Vietnamese states into one territory, which shows the massive disconnect with what Ho Chi Minh had gone and announced during the August Revolution. Actually getting their foot back in the door wasn't very easy for the French, and this highlighted their relegation from the Premier League of international powers after the war. The procedure of accepting the surrender of the Japanese and removing them was taken on by the Chinese in the top half of Vietnam and the British in the bottom half, or above and below the so-called 16th parallel, a line which will demarcate a lot over the next 30 years or so. Crucially, the Chinese above the 16th parallel choose not to allow for a colonial reconquest of Ho Chi Minh's new state in the same way that the British did in and around Saigon. But it will barely be a year before full-scale war between France and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam was unleashed. The French will retake Hanoi, but not extinguish the forces of Vietnamese nationalism. Ho Chi Minh will take his Viet Minh army, around 30,000 strong, and he'll go to the jungles to continue fighting. The First Vietnam War will begin, with French leadership assuming that rebuilding their war-torn economy and remaining a player on the world scene would depend on maintaining their colonies abroad. This war is not about stopping communism. Certainly not to begin with, anyway. Rather, for the Vietnamese, it was primarily a war of national liberation, led by communists. And for the French, it was about rebuilding their vision of prestige and their economy, and the idea of an Indochinese colonial state. A vision that included Cambodia. Cambodia's royalty, like in Vietnam, had declared independence at the behest of the Japanese in 1945, but not gone on to do so quite to the extent that Ho Chi Minh had. As we saw in the last episode, Prime Minister Tan was arrested in a somewhat sad interaction with the returning French, and then Sihanouk, reading from a statement prepared for him by the French, welcomed the French back. I always think it's kind of funny, some of the smaller things that stick out when a country is almost changing hands like this over such a short period of time. Like, the French come back and they see that some of the street names have been changed. You gotta change them back, naturally. Holidays that celebrated the Umbrella Revolt or any nationalist sentiment, well, those have got to be removed. It's all a bit tin pot. But it also highlights the extent to which the French are looking to curtail any natural nationalistic energy from growing. But the agreement signed between the Cambodians and the French that re-establishes that colonial presence, the so-called modus vivendi, signed in 1946, this did make some vague concessions to those who had positioned themselves into the elite sections of Cambodian society. And two primary objectives sprung from that agreement. The first was the drafting of a constitution, and the second was to regain the northwestern provinces that had been ceded to Thailand in the Franco-Thai War. Both of these goals are fairly conciliatory gestures, and both will have consequences, particularly the move towards setting up a constitution, one that creates a national assembly, one that is voted in by universal male suffrage. And resulting from that, almost overnight, Cambodian politics is born. Up until this point, we had kind of just had the French in control of things, making money off the top, while the Cambodian royalty was more or less just there, more symbolic than anything else, a tool used by the French to cement their own power. And now, we're going to have, what, the people voting for political parties? What parties? There's a lot to unpack there, as well as some of the contradictions in trying to create a document that will emphasize the supposedly absolute powers of the king, but also mandate an advisory national assembly that was voted in by, as we said, universal male suffrage. This is a game changer, and in the words of David Chandler in The Tragedy of Cambodian History, he states that, quote, "The French and high-ranking Cambodian officials shared the view that Cambodia's little people were not ready for self-government or for civil rights, and that politics could proceed along the lines of father knows best. Unprepared or not, however, thousands of Cambodians were being asked for the first time to exercise their rights. Almost imperceptibly, the power balance in Cambodia was beginning to shift away from the king and his protectors toward a larger, more unpredictable segment of the population. The consequences of that shift and the tensions it engendered preoccupied Cambodian politicians for another 25 years, until Sihanouk was overthrown. End quote. What Chandler is talking about there is this new spectrum of Cambodian politics which is now on the table. And we will have political parties as well as extreme positions on either side of these parties that will lay the foundations for Cambodian history leading into the Khmer Rouge period. Intermingling with that political spectrum, sometimes above it, sometimes between it, sometimes working to break it, will be the last Devaraja himself, the young Norodom Sihanouk. So let's talk about Cambodian politics for a bit. The right, left, and the middle. And the extremes, because this will set up a few things, as well as take us forward into the late 1940s, but we can kind of branch off into the other parts of the story. First things first. Son Yat-chan, the nationalist hero and co-founder of the first Khmer language newspaper, before becoming prime minister for about 3 months, well, naturally, he wasn't going to be kept around. As we saw, he'd been imprisoned by the French upon their return, designated a troublemaker. They don't need him in the picture. Funnily enough, they actually charge him with treasonous activity and collusion with the Japanese, which, you know, the whole Vichy France government had done, but I guess that's just how it goes. Eventually, he is kind of sent back to France and more or less sentenced just to house arrest. He does a law degree, and we'll see him again in the story soon. But the point is that there's no central figure left over from the 30s or 40s that's going to already just have enough cachet to just be a massive politician in this post-war period. Three political parties form as a result of this new constitution, though. We've got the Democratic Party, led by Prince Yuthivong, the Liberal Party, led by Prince Norodom Norodet, and the Progressive Democrats, led by Prince Norodom Montana. Now, you'll notice from that the royal nature of the leadership there, and it's another reminder of first, just how many princes and princesses there are in the picture, and second, that the king is going to remain an important component going forward. Now, the Democrats are the really interesting party in this early period, as the other two are kind of short-lived and vaguely representative of just conservative or French interests, and they're not going to figure much in our story right now. But of that bunch, Prince Yuthivong, from everything I've read, he seems to have been quite brilliant. Milton Osborne described him as the kind of historical figure that represents a what-could-have-been kind of situation. He becomes the leader of the Democrats and had just returned to Cambodia after having spent almost half of his life in France. He was only 33 in 1946, and he had a doctorate in mathematics as well as a reputation for intellectual integrity. He was not anti-French and had married a French woman. He was honest, inspiring, and hardworking. He was able to connect with the French authorities through the various circles of friends he kept in Paris, but he had been away from Cambodia so long as to not have been trapped by some of the patron-client relations that many other members of the elite had in Cambodia. This put him in quite an appealing position to many young Cambodians, as he represented a kind of alternative to the colonial regime and the collection of puppet rulers that had been installed, but also to the family-oriented sluggishness of the traditional Cambodian elite, in the words of David Chandler. He seems like the best of both worlds, but he was able to operate between them as well. Now, the Democratic Party also drew from a more diverse crowd than the others. This crowd included links to that nationalist movement of the 1930s, like Sim Va, who was a former editor of Nagarvata, as well as members of the educated elite and the Buddhist monastic order. This placed the Democratic Party as the direct descendants of the movement that had begun proper in 1942 and 1945. In a way, they just take up the mantle from those early Khmer nationalists. They had a clear set of ideas, a national organization, and could take advantage of patronage networks. Remember these strings, or kasai, that permeate through Cambodian society. They had these networks through students and schools and Buddhist monasteries. The same people that were drawn to the ideas of Son Yat-sen or Pak Choi-an would be drawn to the Democrats, those who would be seeking independence sooner rather than later, and who may also, overtly or not, support more radical moves toward that goal, goals which groups like the Viet Minh or the Khmer Freedom Fighters, the so-called Issarak, were trying to achieve. The Democrats certainly represent the most progressive of the new political parties, and their strong leadership, connection with the community, and ability to take advantage of the leftover nationalist sentiment that was created by the Nagarvada group. All of this puts them in the strongest position when that first election comes to pass in 1946. They achieve a landslide victory, winning 50 of the 67 seats. Basically, enough to give the Democrats the impression that they had a mandate to rule the country, to achieve their aims. Now, these aims are going to come into conflict with the person, or semi-divine being, rather, whose power is enshrined as absolute in the constitution that's eventually put in place. And also with the French, who are still genuinely in control of things. Sihanouk never had the best relationship with the forebears of the Democrats. His relationship with Son Yat-sen was poor, particularly after that strange little coup against the king, which saw Tan become prime minister for that brief period in 1945. And Sihanouk, now becoming less the playboy puppet and more the eccentric political unit he will become over the next 30 years, well, he's a bit put out by the big victory of the Democrats. And in his memoirs, he was scathing of Prince Yuttevong and the demos, as he called them. I've come to realise that I've called the young king enigmatic on a few occasions throughout the show. Probably not the right phrase. He isn't very mysterious. He gives a lot away, in fact. He's more manic than anything else. The point is that King Sihanouk is put in an interesting position in the wake of the election, and this turn toward a democratic system. He was also brought up in a French education system, so he may have been uncomfortably aware of the parallels between the young Louis XVI and himself when deciding to go along with some of these moves toward liberalizing the political system. In the words of Philip Short, quote, "Sihanouk's motives were mixed. As monarch, he had every intention of preserving the reality of undivided power. But he also saw himself as a modernizer, and wished to appear to his people as such. Moreover, he had acute political antennae. The continuing popularity of Son Yat-sen, in whose arrest he may have secretly connived, troubled him. So did the nationalists' whispered criticisms over the renewal of his entente with the French following Japan's defeat. By deciding to grant his people the right to involve themselves in the political process, he hoped to refurbish an image that had become tarnished." End quote. We will return to this power dynamic between the king and politics more in the next episode, but that's the basics of this early foray into Cambodian political pluralism. But what might be of more interest to us now is to set up the fringes of this system. Probably a bit early to deem them far right or far left, and they're probably further on the spectrum than either of those sides in any case, but it's on these edges, almost literally as well, on like Cambodia's borders, that we will find the growth of alternatives to the colonial system. In the last episode, we saw how the events of the early 1940s had seen many Cambodians, some members of the nationalist movement, even many Buddhist parts of that contingent, joining these more radical sides. Like, after the so-called Umbrella Revolt in 1942, that was violently dispersed by the French, or after that US accidental bombing of a monastery in Phnom Penh. Some of these will become prominent communists under the wing of the Vietnamese. Some will go the other way and find refuge on the other side of Cambodia, with the Thai. And, sometimes confusingly over the next few years of the story, these groups will often intermingle and join forces before breaking apart and becoming adversarial at other times. One of the largest branches on this tree of political fringes are the Khmer Issarak. Now, when I first began studying Cambodian history, I always had trouble trying to nail down exactly who or what this group was. And I think that was the issue, that they aren't a group in the same way you would say the Viet Minh, or later the Khmer Rouge, are, with a more central leadership and hierarchy. The term Issarak could be better reframed as not only the Khmer Independence Committee set up in Bangkok, but also a catch-all term for many of the small bands of private militias, Thai-backed insurgents, or even roaming clusters of bandits that come under the umbrella of Khmer Freedom Fighters, or the Khmer Independence Movement. As we briefly touched on in the last episode, this movement originally grew out of that Khmer Independence Committee. In the words of Ben Kiernan, this had been set up in Bangkok in December 1940 by Pok Kun, former director of a Battambang pawn shop who had been dismissed on discovery of accounting irregularities and had fled to Thailand in 1939. You'll recall this is all around the time of the Franco-Thai War, and following that conflict with the northwestern provinces becoming part of Thailand, there's a vested interest for the Thai to be supporting, or at least funding, Cambodian resistance against the French within these areas. When the French are, you know, back after the Second World War, resistance, as it were, for these Thai-backed groups against the colonial power took the shape of rural violence and harassment of French-controlled towns, cities, etc., by these kinds of guerrilla bands, with varying degrees of direct Thai support. Now, perhaps it would be easier to conceptualize the Issarak as something like the way we view criminal gangs in society today, but throw in there a degree of political goals and allegiances. Like many gangs, they make their money through illegitimate means, They're armed, they use violence to achieve their aims. And if we are talking about, you know, mafia levels of activity, we might even see areas that are set up in which they control and even levy taxes on the local people. But in this case, if we went up to the gang leader or mob boss and asked who they were with, they might say, "Look, we aren't just a group of bandits or criminals. We are fighting for the people. We are fighting for independence for this country. We are Issarak." To give you a concrete example of the kind of mishmash of people that are going to be operating under this Issarak banner, on the morning of Sunday, April 7th, 1946, a group of about 50, armed with old-fashioned muskets and a couple of machine guns, they attack the Grand Hotel in Siem Reap. This is where most of the returned French officer corps was staying. Over the course of about 6 hours, they seized the city, and smaller groups tried to let out prisoners out of local jails, and they attacked houses of government officials. Eventually they're driven off, but they had left 7 Frenchmen dead, and took with them a solid amount of arms and ammunition. They then retreated to the ruins of Angkor, before moving further north to the Dangrek Mountains on the border with Thailand. Now, some of the emerging leaders within this Issarak movement, in fact, some of the leaders that instigated that attack on Siem Reap, I can almost imagine them, you know, in this guerrilla war against the French, as this kind of motley crew, like getting these Inglorious Bastards Tarantino-style introductions. For instance, we've got probably the most prominent figure in the movement in the early days, DAP, Sergeant Chuan. And if there was a, you know, a caption for the sergeant, or if he was being introduced into a boxing match, a wrestling match, it might be something like, you know, "Ladies and gentlemen, here he is, the one and only magical warlord from the sacred mountains, leader of 200 bloodthirsty ex-Nazis, 300 Japanese warriors. He's got 200 women with him and a whole bunch of other followers. It's the skinny man who's invulnerable to bullets, Dap Chuan." As David Chandler says, the girls and followers were real enough, but the kind of fanciful report that I read those figures from was undoubtedly throwing in those Axis deserters to make him sound a bit more formidable than he was. Yeah, Sergeant Chuan. The guy got the name from his time in the Cambodian militia and defecting to the Thai army and then being sent back into the provinces of Cambodia around Siem Reap, the Kulin Mountains, in fact. That's where Jayavarman II first proclaimed himself as a universal monarch. There's a fair bit of history there. That's where he's able to build this following among the locals. He becomes a warlord, essentially, and in many rural areas of Cambodia, you'll notice that people that can gain infamy there will often be able to translate that into supernatural powers as well. Dap Chuan, Dap simply means sergeant in Thai, he will linger in our story here and there as one of the larger figures in the Issarak movement. And he's fascinating. He's got this extremely thin physique and apparently deep-set, unblinking eyes. And these feats of strength that he would perform, which apparently demonstrated his supernatural abilities. His wife was also a sorcerer that could provide him protection from bullets. Like I said, it's great stuff. It's got this almost fictional ragtag group of misfits try and maintain an anti-colonial resistance movement kind of vibe. Make a great movie. And he isn't the only character either. This relatively well-armed force that attacked Siem Reap was also led by a member of the royal family, Norodom Chentarangsi. The young prince had found his way into military life in the Cambodian militias that were organized by the Japanese in the aftermath of their coup. He was the cousin of Sihanouk's father, and was a couple of years younger than the king himself. He had escaped to Thailand when the French came back at the end of 1945, and there he joined the Issarak. He also began amassing his own small private army. We could dub Chentarangsi like the rebel prince, and alongside him and the magical sergeant is one of the first members of the Khmer Communists, the former monk Son Yeok-min. Now, for those of you like me that may be affected by that kind of cultural gap, where some names seem to be harder to differentiate and remember because they're not very familiar to you, you probably heard that name I just said. It might have sounded kind of like an audible blur. Did he say Ho Chi Minh? No. Was it Son Yeok-tan? The nationalist guy with the newspaper? Nope. It was a mixture of the two. And there's a reason for that. Pham Van Hoa, a former member of the monkhood who had fled Cambodia to join the Viet Minh and subsequently the Indochinese Communist Party, had took on the name Son Yeok-min in an attempt to cash in on the popularity of Ho Chi Minh and Son Yeok-tan, like those off-brands that are just legally distinct enough from the real thing to get away with it. Could we perhaps term this choice of name a knockoff? Is that really stupid? Maybe. But, you know, we're going to put him in. You know, we've got the magical warlords, we've got armed rebel princes, we've got monks turned revolutionaries, and we've also got some straight up bandits that we're going to throw in as well. One gang under the Issarak banner will be led by a man who French sources call a cheap hoodlum, named Phut Chai. A repeat offender with a few jail sentences, the kind of guy who will shoot dead 4 police officers. Chandler says that he fitted the accepted image of a bandit, being a heavy drinker, a womanizer, fond of magic, cruel to prisoners, and protective of his entourage. He, like Dap Chuan, was also thought to possess supernatural powers. Chai will end up controlling a group of maybe 1,000 men by the end of 1948. And on the topic of magic, as it has come up a few times, well, just now, it may be worth illustrating the kind of thing we are talking about here. But in doing so, I will use perhaps the most extreme example. Now, this may be upsetting to hear about, so feel free to skip this section if you are sensitive to what amounts to a quite graphic practice. It's the infamous Khun Krak, the Smoke Children. Again, I'll reiterate that on the spectrum of cultural practices, as seen from an outside point of view, this rates as fairly extreme. I'm not trying to paint the rest in the same colour, it's just that this one is related directly to the kind of magic that might be employed by a warlord. Okay, this Khun Krak. Essentially, it's the practice of, I guess you could say, creating a magical talisman that not only protects its user, it can also do much more. The talisman, however, is made from an unborn fetus, one that is cut or ripped out of its mother, and as far as I can tell, usually by the father. The wife or mistress of this man dies in the process, and he will then mummify the fetus over a fire before taking it to a monk or other skilled magic user, who can then awaken it with an incantation. The unborn baby is sewn into a pouch with special stones, and its owner, or I guess within the language of the ritual itself, the father of the talisman, must continue to feed it with offerings at an altar which is arranged in the home. A bond and a special relationship forms between father and this smoke child, and it is from that relationship that the magic is derived. Supposedly the protection from bullets being one aspect of this, as well as being able to offer him advice or making him invisible to his enemies. While researching this practice, I stumbled upon a blog post going over some of the details. It also pointed toward a website which described itself as one of the best and most trustworthy online stores for amulets in Thailand, where one of these Kunkrak amulets had been advertised in 2008. The listing was still there, as well as the photo of the amulet itself, which was quite confronting. The item was out of stock. The description relayed the fact that an old Khmer magic book was one source that the creator of the amulet was able to consult. Now, I realize that's a bit grim, but I thought I would mention the kind of practice that we would usually dub superstition. Well, it's still lingering today. And, well, one person's religion is another person's superstition, so it's all kind of relative there. But the point is that we shouldn't lose sight of some of the cultural context of Cambodia when discussing this historical hurricane. It's going to rely on forces from within and abroad. And yeah, if you think that someone in 2008 was happy enough to purchase this kind of amulet, then imagine how prevalent ideas about magic and sorcery may have been in rural areas of Cambodia more than half a century prior to this. But if we zoom out a bit on this whole Issarak movement, despite the involvement of some fairly nefarious characters, we can generally place their aims somewhere toward achieving an independent Cambodia. So, vaguely nationalist and anti-colonial, but not necessarily communist. Like, you've got bandits with patches of support from local rural areas, but you've also got Thai political groups involved. Then you've got someone like the rebel prince, Chantarangzi, and then you've got straight-up communists under that banner that have come out of the tutelage of the Vietnamese, like Son Yoc Min, and the other monk we mentioned in the last episode, Tu Samut. The Viet Minh and the now clandestine Indochinese Communist Party had been recruiting extensively since the end of the Second World War, particularly in regions on the border with Vietnam, as well as in certain plantations managed by the French that relied a lot more on Vietnamese labour as opposed to Cambodian. You've also got students beginning to involve themselves in this movement, and many will become committed revolutionaries and communists, like Long Bun Rut, who was studying at a university in Bangkok and joined the Thai Communist Party, and he will eventually take the name Non Chea and become one of the most important members of the Khmer Rouge. This won't be uncommon either. Later, many who make up the ranks of the Khmer Rouge will have had some kind of experience in either the Issarak or the Viet Minh camp during this time. But for the most part, the intellectual elite and the younger students, mostly in Phnom Penh, they're going to be more drawn to the new Democratic Party rather than these fringe elements. For now, that is. It's all quite a rich tapestry. Eventually, different Issarak groups, both from the Viet Minh side of things and the more Thai-influenced side, or what we could deem, I guess, the communist and non-communist anti-colonial movements, although that's oversimplifying to a degree, well, they end up creating a unified Khmer People's Liberation Committee. But I would consider it to be a fairly fractured group with no central organization and only half-baked plans, aside from generally roving about, trying to steal or purchase arms. And in some cases, like with Dap Chuan, you've got someone more or less just trying to create power for themselves. But what we've got here is a scenario where the French are engaged in fighting. They are certainly not in complete control in all of Cambodia. Not to mention the situation going on in Vietnam. French outposts or supply trains will end up taking enough hits here and there that they may even need to be letting some of these larger areas come under the control of the Issarak, so they aren't running the risk of local security forces being killed and their arms and precious ammunition falling into these anti-government hands. And it's not all rosy Robin Hood stuff either. These kinds of civil conflicts can rarely be boiled down to good versus bad, even if you consider the French presence in Indochina to be unethical. It doesn't necessarily mean that those working against that project are justified in whatever means they choose to use. Ben Kiernan, in How Pol Pot Came to Power, mentions the political degeneration of the Issarak as they slaughtered over 100 members of a Catholic-majority village near Battambang in November 1946. Philip Short, in his biography of Pol Pot, even mentions this meme of killing people who wore glasses, mostly associated with the Khmer Rouge, actually beginning with these Issarak groups who were persecuting those bearing this apparent mark of education as some kind of obvious link to the French, and killing them as an act of anti-imperialism. But what are we talking about here? We've got magic men, Thai-backed Viet Minh, organized communist warlords, princes, bandits. Then in the more, well, the places under control of France and Phnom Penh, you've now got a national assembly led by the Democratic Party, but who in the end are kind of, well, at least supposed to be, under the power of King Sihanouk. But in reality, it's still just the French who maintain the real power. There are a lot of competing interests, and it's kind of a mess, isn't it? It's unstable. This situation will develop some very interesting flavors over the course of the next episode, particularly when we dive into the Viet Minh side of these fringe elements. Because the not-so-subtle ways that the Thai were supporting the Issarak will dry up as we approach the 1950s, and this is due to a change in policy by a new Thai government, as well as the negotiations of the French, which see the northwestern provinces of Battambang and Siem Reap given back again to the Cambodians. As the First Indochina War intensifies, the Vietnamese will also look to widen the conflict, and the Issarak will be supported more by Cambodia's eastern neighbour rather than the western. That will have lots of fun things to explore when we start putting the more nationalist aims of many of these Issarak groups. And we put that side by side with the goals of the Vietnamese, and the mixture of needs, nationalist versus communist energy, Not to mention the hereditary enemy kind of stuff. It's going to create a lot of friction. Like, consider this bit of Isarak declaration from a tract found in the eastern areas around 1947. It said, "The Cambodian race, Cambodian blood, and Cambodian nationality are all the children of His Majesty Jayavarman, the builder of Angkor Thom and Angkor Wat. Rise up, open your eyes, get back onto the proper path." Another bit of propaganda stressed the needs of the Buddha as a reason to join the Isarak. This is highly nationalist rhetoric, stressing the grandiosity of the Cambodian past, which is usually not something that will gel particularly well with A, cooperation with the Vietnamese, or B, the internationalist orientation of Marxist-Leninism as being taught by the Viet Minh. Again, this theme will feature prominently in part two and all the way through the rest of this series. But let's zoom out even more here and just try and put into context what we've been talking about and how everything is starting to fit together. So we've got the French coming back and trying to introduce some reforms on their possession in Indochina, in their eyes perhaps kind of patronizingly letting the natives play politics. And we have this spectrum where there's a moderate kind of center where attempts are being made to progress Cambodia toward some kind of functional independence via political advancements. This is represented by a group like the Democratic Party. Then you've got these other extreme positions, where this is trying to be achieved through force and anti-colonial violence. And then, kind of outside of that, outside of these earthly ambitions, you've got King Sihanouk, who is at this point still kind of biding his time. He wants independence too, but in a way that's going to preserve his interests the most. And above him, well, you've got the French, and they're willing to fight a long and dirty war with the people of Indochina if it means that this territory remains in their possession. Now, in 1947, perhaps the what-if moment that Milton Osborne referred to in regard to Prince Yuttevong of the Democrats occurs. The prince dies, and one of the most politically adept persons within that central, moderate position on the political spectrum is taken out of the equation. The Democrats don't really recover from this blow either, the party falling into fractious elements without their impressive leader there anymore. And despite them holding power in the country's new National Assembly, they simply won't have the power to effect much change, and certainly won't be able to achieve independence through their own means. But independence for Cambodia is coming, and the path that this country charts toward it will overlap with the formative years of many who will become central to the eventual Khmer Rouge leadership, including our somewhat mediocre student, returning from his summer holiday at Angkor. So, by 1947, the year that we can pick up Salot Sa's story once again, what do we really know about the young man? The man who will eventually take the reins of one of the most criminally negligent, abusive, and murderous regimes of the 20th century. And with that in mind, well, there's nothing so far that we can really point to and say that he was a particularly bad egg nothing to even indicate that he had the ambition to get to a position where the quality of the egg would have any real bearing. David Chandler puts this nicely in his biography of the future leader of the Khmer Rouge. Quote, "Many of Salazar's contemporaries followed the same path he did, but most of them earned at least one diploma, came from a less cosseted milieu, and made more of an impression on people than Salazar did. No one I met in the course of my research who knew Saar before 1952 admitted picking him as a potential leader or professional success." Here again, we encounter the question of Saar's personality. Was he deliberately effacing himself? Was he genuinely mediocre? Or was he indifferent to making a strong impression? End quote. There are a few things to pick up on in that quote that we have gone over. Like, he didn't come from a particularly poor background. Sure, his family was not part of some big land-owning urban class, but they were not on the bottom strata of Cambodian society either. If we remember the discussion about village life in episode 7, Saar's family would have been positioned somewhere near the top of that social hierarchy because of the amount of paddies they owned and the fact that they were not simply subsistence farmers. They were turning their surplus into profit. They also had connections to the royal family, and by this time sent a number of their children to Phnom Penh to work in and around the palace, or as we've seen, to become entwined in the bedchamber of the king in some way or another. Saar had received multiple levels of education by this point. In 1947, only a few thousand other Cambodians had progressed as far as he had. He is 22 by the time he makes his way back to Phnom Penh to gain entry into the prestigious Lycée Sisawat, a school that a fairly mediocre student like himself was probably lucky to get into, perhaps owing to some of the disruptions that had lingered from the Second World War. And at 22, I mean, that seems fairly old to a modern audience. You know, someone still in high school at 22. There's a lot of factors at play here, including the time he was originally sent to school, as well as being held back a few years. And from what I've read, this is a fairly normal part of the culture to change the date of birth to correspond to the admittance of elementary school. So, officially, he's only 20. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, well, he's not a kid anymore, is he? He hadn't had a job by this point. Certainly nothing that would have provided a soul-crushing experience of capitalism, or even colonialism that other revolutionaries might have faced. Nothing in a textile factory or a brutal rubber plantation, or even, you know, in regards to a Khmer lifestyle. It's not like he's breaking his back planting rice, either. By this point in his life, what would lead us to say he was living anything but a fairly privileged existence? But he wasn't even particularly interested in politics, either. Aside from this vague idolization of Son Yat-chan that many students had at this time, he was just kind of regular. Which I suppose makes the next few years of his life vitally important. Because there must be something developing there. Something under the surface. Well, perhaps not. I mean, maybe it will work the other way around. And the world will impose on him the conditions to become a leader. It's like sometimes you look at your own life and you just say, how the heck did I get here? Did I choose the paths that led to this? Was it my personality that led here? Or were there doors and the ways through them being opened without me even knowing? No, let's leave the conversations about determinism, free will, multiple universes, and nature versus nurture to the side for now, as we just trace the lines that Saar and others do end up taking in these crucial phases of their lives. Alright, so we actually have a bit of a gap in the historical knowledge of Salat Saar in 1946, the year after we left him in his holiday. But we know that he is back in Phnom Penh by 1947, because he and a few of his classmates from Kampong Cham pass an entrance exam to get into the Lassi Sisawat, as we touched on just before. Here, Saar is once again living with his elder brother Suang, but as he is now enrolled at the Sisawat, we will see these small town Cambodian history vibes again, and he's going to come into contact with another hugely important member of the eventual Communist Party of Kampuchea, Yang Sari. Now, we introduced Sari in the last episode. He had spoken about the Monks' Rebellion in 1942 as giving him this introduction to the meaning of the word nation, which I think already gives us a kind of clue to the political switched onedness of himself as opposed to Saar in their late teens. They'll become friends, but it's interesting to compare them at this point, considering where they will end up. Like, Yang Sari seems to fit the idea of a would-be revolutionary much more than the boy who would end up being Pol Pot. Yang Sari seems like the classic intellectual Marxist. Sari was born Kim Tran in a Cambodian minority district of southern Vietnam. He lived a much less sheltered life than Saar. He was born to a prosperous landowner, but when he was very young, his father died, and the family fell on hard times. His mother managed to send him to elementary school, but at the age of 14, he was put to work selling ferry tickets at Nek Luang, on the outskirts of the capital. Eventually, with the help of a brother who had secured work at a provincial governor's office, he was relocated to Prey Veng province, where he was adopted by an elderly Buddhist teacher named Yang. He did exceptionally well at school and went to Phnom Penh to pursue a further education. He was awarded a scholarship in 1945 to attend the prestigious Lassi Sisawat. By the 1940s, he had developed a passion for politics and was devouring writings by French Enlightenment figures like Voltaire, who stressed the kinds of political developments that were sorely lacking in Cambodia. So, while Saar had become part of an intellectual elite just by dint of continuing his education to a level beyond which the vast majority of Cambodians hadn't, not to mention his fortuitous links with the royal palace, Sari strikes me as a genuine intellectual who would naturally be drawn toward politics and changing the country. But like many others, he will befriend Saar during their time together as students, probably drawn to him in the way you are to any kind of affable, easygoing person in high school. Sari will, from an early stage, join the cause of the Democrats, like many other students and alumni of the Lassi Sisawat, and he will begin volunteering for them and helping out with their activities. In fact, it's through his connections to this party that he first encounters the Communist Manifesto. This taboo text had been brought back to Cambodia by the former leader of the Democrats, the brilliant Prince Yuttevong, and had been passed on to his brother after his death. Yang Sari and another student at the Sisawat, Rat Samuen, having found it in the library of its new owner, began to study it quite closely. Not Salat Saar, though. He's not going to be involved with that text for a while. After a year or so at the Lycée Cecil Watt, which I mean, I feel like I may have overstated his averageness before. Like, it's not nothing that he was able to pass the exams to get in, but in 1948, he and his friend, Lon Non, well, they sit an exam called the Brevet, which is kind of like a test which determines eligibility to get into those very last years of high school and sets you on track toward a university degree. Both he and Lon Non fail. Non's parents were rich enough to send him to France to continue his education, but Sarr would not make a similarly glamorous move. Instead, he gets into a technical school in the northern suburbs of Phnom Penh. I think, depending on where you live, you probably have a different name for this kind of school. Maybe a trade school? A vocational school? In Australia, we call it TAFE. Philip Short describes what this may have been like for the young Pol Pot, though. Quote, "It cannot have been a happy move. The place itself was depressing. Two long dormitory huts and a collection of barrack-like workshops that looked as though they dated from the Industrial Revolution." For a young man who had been on track for the baccalaureate and the possibility of a university education, it must have been a dreadful come-down. His former classmate Kyu Sampan remembered, "Most students used to look disdainfully at the boys at the technical school. No one wanted to be seen with them. They had a reputation as toughies. When the apprentices, as they were mockingly called, played football against other schools, the match invariably degenerated into a brawl, and they would bring out the brass knuckles they had made in their metalwork classes." End quote. At the technical school, Sarr will study carpentry, and here he will add another change of circumstance to a growing list that Philip Short once again neatly identifies, from a childhood in the countryside to then becoming a Buddhist novitiate in Phnom Penh, then a Roman Catholic primary school, then adolescence in Phnom Penh, in and around the king's harem, as we detailed some of that activity in a previous episode, then a middle school education imbued with the values of Vichy France, then to the prestigious Lycée Cecil Watt, where he was surrounded by the who's who of intellectuals in the country, and now finally among the boilermakers, tinsmiths, and carpenters at the trade school in Rossikio. Short goes on to say that this all gave Sarr one great advantage. He was able to communicate naturally with people of all sorts and conditions. I tend to call people like this conversational spanners, because no matter what situation you're in with someone, they find something to talk about, something to be able to connect with you on. The kind of people that aren't awkward at parties. May Man, a contemporary of Sarr at this point in their lives, later recalled Sarr's famous smile, and I'll quote him here, "as well as the fact that he never said too much. He liked to joke, and there was a slightly mischievous way about him. There was never a hint of what he would become after, though." End quote. It's perhaps at this point in 1949 that the path does change course. Not by choice, but because there was a silver lining in Sarr's forced move toward this technical education. The Democrats in power, having inherited many of the values initiated by the Nagarvada group, well, they placed a high value in Cambodians needing to gain more traction and education in fields like radioelectricity, carpentry, tailoring, and photography. These were all filled by ethnic Vietnamese in Cambodia, and they thought in order for the Khmer to progress, they would need to start taking these industries for themselves. This was even thought of as one of the most important steps toward independence. So in order to facilitate that change, they organized for a number of scholarships to be granted to students at the technical school so they could pursue further study at French engineering schools. Salazar was going to get one of those scholarships. His brother Suong would later deny that Tsar was awarded this because of the connections to the royal palace, and other historians might point to the friendship between Tsar and Yang Seri, having led the Democrats in charge of the selection, to maybe look at Salazar favourably. Perhaps it was just down to his good grades, and the fact that he was fluent in French, and an ideal candidate to keep up this technical training abroad. Whichever reason it may have been, Tsar was going to become, once again, part of another extremely minuscule elite. At this point, fewer than 250 Cambodians had been trained abroad since the beginning of the century, including those sent by their families without government support. It was such a big deal, in fact, that he and the others awarded this privilege were going to get an audience with the king. By August of 1949, King Sihanouk had become more active in domestic politics, as well as in his efforts to try and get the French to concede more autonomy to Cambodia. Before this, he had still lived a fairly self-indulgent life within the palace, still devoted to cinema, and now making his own amateur film dramas, something that we will return to again as this passion becomes quite consuming in the late 1960s. But due to a variety of factors in the kingdom, Sihanouk had begun stepping into the role that we're more familiar with him playing. Both the French and Sihanouk had grown disenchanted by the Democrats, as they began to suspect, correctly as claimed by David Chandler, that the new political party, well, they were trying to govern Cambodia without their supervision or advice. Amongst deepening financial troubles exacerbated by the activities of the ISARAC and the Viet Minh out in the countryside, as well as the lack of any real movement toward independence, well, a multitude of factors led Sihanouk to become increasingly involved in Cambodia's politics. Whether this may have had something to do with trying to maintain his own position should probably be thrown in there as well. So it's against this backdrop that Salazar and 20 other young men were summoned to the royal palace and lined up in their new suits. Each was handed an envelope in front of King Sihanouk, himself only a few years older, and it contained about 500 piastre, roughly $30, but enough to live on for about a month in Paris. It's not bad at all. It's fascinating little scenario here because we have two hugely influential figures in the same room, each with no idea just how much is about to change, and perhaps the roles that they are going to fulfill in that change. Salazar, he's going to return from France as a revolutionary and a communist. Sihanouk, in the weeks following this encounter, he's going to continue steps toward his complete dominance of Cambodian politics when he utilizes a constitutional provision that states that all power emanates from him. He uses that to dissolve the parliament, and he starts ruling by decree. This is another early lightning strike in the steadily advancing historical hurricane, and it would have illuminated the smiling faces of two young Khmer, one a king, one a student, roughly the same age, pleasantly exchanging an envelope. And 26 years before the young man receiving this gift, he will lead a movement that abolishes the money within it. We've got a king who will preside over a country's journey toward the brink of disaster, and we've got him sat next to a revolutionary who will eventually, well, push it off the cliff. Au revoir, bon voyage. The day after the ceremony with Sihanouk, Sa and the other recipients of the scholarship travelled by bus to Saigon, where they spent a few weeks waiting for their visas before making their way to the port. They would be travelling to France on a passenger liner which had been converted into a troop-carrying ship in order to facilitate the greater number of soldiers travelling to Indochina to fight the Viet Minh. Philip Short includes a fun little description of their journey, with Sa becoming a cook for some of his fellow Cambodian travellers after they grew sick and tired of the French cuisine served, growing closer to a boy named Mae Man, who was more politically active and interested than Sa. They spent nights sleeping on deck, worrying about how cold France was going to be, and sharing wine that Sa had been able to procure from some French soldiers he had befriended. Man recalled that they never spoke about politics, so we're still no closer to some moment of foreshadowing where our future despot begins casually mentioning how he would like to topple the government or murder Cambodia's ethnic minorities. Their arrival in France after almost a month at sea must have been an almost overwhelming experience for the young men. I think those who travel around the world today probably get glimpses of this feeling when arriving somewhere new and fantastic. But cities are generally cities, or perhaps those who grew up in the country and moved to a big city later, like I did. I don't know, I guess I remember that early sense of awe at just the different scale of things or how many people were around you, but I don't think we would really be able to compare that to stepping into what would have almost seemed like a different world for these guys. I mean, the boys on this trip had said that arriving in Vietnam's just southern capital of Saigon, that had made them feel like country bumpkins. And from there to Paris? That's something else. One of the reasons I keep referring to Philip Short's biography of Pol Pot is not just because of how much research and brilliant analysis is in there, but also because of his evocative writing style. It's really well illustrated in his description of Sa's arrival in Paris, so I think paraphrasing him and editing out some of the harder to pronounce French might be the way to go here. So, quote, "So Sa and his companions disembarked into a glittering, chaotic, intimidating new world on the morning of October 1st, 1949. Having travelled up on the overnight train from Marseille, they were met at the Gare de Lyon by an official of the French Education Ministry, responsible for colonials, and more helpfully, by representatives of the Khmer Student Association. It was a Saturday, and it was raining. The temperature that afternoon was barely 15 degrees Celsius, colder than the worst winter day in Cambodia. None of them had winter outfits. Mae Man remembered being taken to a second-hand clothes market where he discovered to his delight that they could haggle with the Jewish stallholders, just as they did with Khmer traders at home. Eventually, the young Cambodians will climb the Eiffel Tower and will marvel at the ancient stonework of Notre Dame and the broad, tree-lined boulevards with their elegant boutiques, classical facades, and polished Belle Epoque department stores, and all the beauty and structure of the city, as one of them put it, a city that had rebounded from wartime austerity and was experiencing a cultural and social ferment not seen since the 1920s. End quote. Now we'll get back to echoing some more of Short's lovely writing in a bit, as well as to one of the broader, I guess you could say, contentions that he brings to the Pol Pot story, or the history that's bound up in this French chapter. But first, let's just get Sartre settled in and start to look into the circumstances of his time in Paris that will, as Short says, lay down the ideological foundations of which the Khmer Rouge nightmare will be built. So if you've ever been what I guess is basically an exchange student, you might be familiar with the kind of thing that Sartre and the others were experiencing when arriving in the new country. You get shown around a lot of places, there are certain areas that you are more or less expected to hang around, and your lodgings might be prepared for you as well. Many of the students go along with that, and others choose to find their own way. Some of the Khmer arrivals were happy to get a kind of servant's room in some larger apartment in different quarters throughout the city. But Sartre finds himself again the beneficiary of his family's subtle royal connections. One of King Monivong's nephews, that's the king who died in 1941 at Bacaw Hill Station with Salotsar's sister and the favoured concubine of the king named Roeng. She was by his side. Anyway, one of his nephews, a Prince Somonopong, he had arrived in Paris the year before to study at the École Française de Radio-Électricité, which I'm going to presume not only have I hacked, but probably stands for the French School of Radio Electricity. This was the same school that Sartre was going to attend. In fact, as Short suggests, the young Pol Pot may have actually switched his focus from carpentry, which he was studying at the technical school in Phnom Penh, towards radio technology in Paris, because of the steps that Somonopong had already made. This Prince Somonopong, whose mother also held a position comparable to Roeng, well, he took the newly arrived Sartre under his wing and found a place for him to stay along with two other friends, who were sons, I believe, of a governor of a province in Cambodia. Now, I want to linger on that point just slightly again, because it's worth pointing out that Sartre never referred to this royal connection in any recollections after his time in Paris, preferring to downplay the whole thing by saying he spent the first year abroad just living with a cousin. Again, we see this mix of a fairly humble background, but also continual circumstances that see him set amongst Cambodia's elite, this time in Paris. And it's never due to some kind of innate brilliance that sees his stock naturally rise to the top. He isn't self-made in the same way that perhaps someone like Yang Sari is. He seems to be able to ride his luck to an extent. I feel like we all might know someone in our lives that, you know, they just have this good energy about them. Doors seem to open or opportunities seem to arise from a mixture of who they know and how much people like them. But it's also another example of how Sartre is able to mix with different crowds. I mean, one day he's striking up friendships with French soldiers on a passenger ship. The next he's hanging out with sons of governors and princes in Paris. You can imagine a certain level of comfort and confidence that would come from these kinds of variegated encounters and friendships. But it also doesn't strike us as much of the life of a revolutionary so far, does it? I mean, compared to, say, Ho Chi Minh, who we spoke about a few episodes ago, he was almost born into that life, and it seemed like everything that happened to him served as some lesson of socialism that led him to Marxism and Lenin. He didn't come to Paris on a scholarship. He came because he was working on the boat. And at this point in the story, he just seems like a normal guy, making his way in the world. Nothing he is doing is really worth chastising or frowning upon. He's just being himself. Sa's first year in Paris was probably something akin to what many students living away from home experience. He joins the Khmer Student Association and helps out with their activities. He gets pretty good grades, indulges in the lifestyle. A lifestyle which would have been pretty wild at the time, I guess. This is Paris in the 1950s. May Mann recalled going late one night to a cellar club full of bebop and jazz, everyone dressed in black. These are the same clubs that, you know, Camus and Sartre used to go. It's worth spending a little time on that as well. It's just the mix of the idea of Paris with the context of what's going on in the world in the early 1950s and how these guys are going to experience that. Philip Short, again, captures this eloquently when he states, quote, "Since the time of Beaumarchais and Voltaire, Paris has called itself, with fine indifference to the intellectual claims of other European centres, La Ville Lumière, the source of light and of enlightenment for the rest of the civilized world." End quote. I find this a little bit to be like how certain very famous football clubs will have a kind of motto, a philosophy, that's supposed to underpin their actions on the pitch. Certain clubs will have a reputation for playing a certain way, and might emphasize some past achievements or trophy or group of players that this philosophy comes from. Cities can sometimes act in similar ways, and Paris, as we have seen it numerous times throughout this series, and why I purposely included many of those instances, what's one of those cities? As Short said, this idea of a source of light, indeed the Enlightenment, as we saw in one of those earlier episodes, through to the kinds of values intended to be shown by the French Revolution, and even later by the Paris Commune. As David Chandler says in his biography of Pol Pot, quote, "The City of Light had retained a reputation for over a century as a vibrant intellectual centre. In 1949, artists, politicians, writers, philosophers, and musicians mingled in the contending schools of existentialism, post-impressionism, phenomenology, Gaullism, and communism, to name only five. New developments in these fields and many others made Paris an intoxicating place for young people engaged in tertiary study, as did the city's traditions of liberty and revolutionary thought. Political parties and the newspapers affiliated with them flourished across the ideological spectrum, giving rise to lively, acrimonious debate." End quote. So we have this situation where these students, part of an intellectual elite in Cambodia, are thrust into one of the most politically and philosophically energetic cities in the world. Naturally, they were going to fall into it. But when they were there is almost important as where they were. As the time that these Khmer students were in Paris was also the heyday of the French Communist Party, one of the strongest political parties in France at that time, and also considered to be one of the most Stalinist parties outside of Eastern Europe. Chandler suggests that this period also coincided with the last years of Stalin's life, and therefore the climax of the so-called cult of personality that was surrounding him. And we saw some of the results of that in an earlier episode as well. If we zoom out slightly again, we have another coincidence on the table here, where the day that Salazar set foot in France on the 1st of October 1949, that's also the day that Mao Zedong proclaimed the People's Republic of China. Back in Indochina, we also see the idea of a brave communist-led struggle against the French Empire. It must have seemed like communism was the wave of the future. This is where we have the historical hurricane properly developing. This is like the point during the weather forecast where they show you the infrared picture of the massive storm with the eye in its center spinning around. But it's way off the coast still. It isn't near land. And we don't quite know just how destructive it may get, but it's there. This is the culmination of so many things. The Enlightenment in France, the spread of colonies across the globe, the French Revolution, the Industrial Revolution, world wars, communism, nationalism. It is this absolute maelstrom that these Khmer students are thrown into. And these are students who themselves are deep products of the kind of factors and events we have touched on throughout the show. And this is kind of what Philip Short paints a quite convincing picture of in his historical analysis. He contends that the foreign intellectual legacy that would underpin the Cambodian Revolution was first and foremost French. Quote, "How could it have been otherwise? Language forms the building blocks of thought. The Cambodian students spoke French. They had attended French schools, and they had grown up in a French colony. French was the prism through which they viewed the outside world." End quote. We will pick up on this idea again, particularly with how it relates to the idea of the French Revolution and the parallels between 18th century France and 20th century Cambodia. I think it's a fascinating way of thinking about it, and definitely overlaps with this mixture of circumstances and long historical forces that come together, and how someone like Salazar is going to fit into that bigger process. As we were saying before, Salazar's first year in Paris seems to have been fairly typical for an exchange student, getting used to the new surroundings, putting yourself into student life. He narrowly fails his end-of-year exams at the radio electricity school, but was allowed to sit them again. Second time was better, and he was able to re-enroll for the second year. But in the break between semesters, or I guess what we would just call the summer holidays, an announcement came up in the Khmer Student Association, or an offer, really, basically for those interested in going abroad over their break. You could go on a month-long camping tour in Switzerland, or you could participate in an international labour brigade in Yugoslavia. This was basically volunteering to go and help with the post-war reconstruction there, which doesn't sound quite as fun as the tour through Switzerland. And perhaps the fact that Saar chose to join the student labour brigade, maybe this is a sign of his metamorphosis into a revolutionary. Well, not quite. See, the thing is, the Swiss tour cost 22,000 francs or something, like 70 US dollars. money that Saar definitely didn't have lying around. There wasn't much of a choice for him, really. And later, he recalled, "I didn't have the money, so I couldn't do as the others and go to Geneva, or to the sea, or the mountains, and have a holiday there. A group of us poorer students went instead to Zagreb, and worked on building a motorway." So, as he says there, it's nothing fancy, but it's certainly an interesting way to spend your summer holidays as a student. In reality, the trip was kind of brutal. It began with a 48-hour train journey with lengthy stops and no food to be had, and the foreign volunteers that arrived were expected to participate in the manual labour 3 days a week, from 6 in the morning until noon. Apparently the food provided at the worksite wasn't very fulfilling either, but the students weren't able to get much better at local restaurants. Still, certainly an experience. One of the members of the Khmer volunteers on this month-long trip, a boy named Yang, wrote a letter to the Yugoslav authorities to thank them for the opportunity. An opportunity which he describes in glowing terms. Chandler quotes Yang's letter at length, and I'll relay some of it to you. Quote, "Everywhere, the People's Federal Republic of Yugoslavia resembles an enormous worksite where factories, roads, railways, and hydraulic centers are being built. This effort is also worthy of praise because the strength of all the people united around their leaders gives them the chance of gaining successive victories, knowing that it is a question of national survival." End quote. Chandler actually asks the reader to imagine the young Salot Saar having the same kind of impression on this trip. And that's probably not stretching our historical imagination too far either, considering the echoes of this dramatic mobilization of a nation's people in democratic Kampuchea. That summer, Yugoslavia was suffering from a severe drought and famine, as well as food riots and even a possible invasion from the Soviet Union, as their leader Tito had broke away from Stalin in this kind of national-based communism, which had isolated Yugoslavia in a lot of ways. This example of massive labor forces was also something similar to what we saw in the early stages of the Soviet Revolution. You'll remember Lenin's war communism. This was the harnessing of that political energy in the people through communist and nationalist ideology. It's even interesting paying attention just to some of the phrases that Yang used in his letter, because ideas about national survival, winning successive victories for the state, as well as the notion of turning the country into an enormous worksite, all of this is foreshadowing the good intentions that underpin the grim reality of Pol Pot's vision of Cambodia. Now, this trip, this stands out, doesn't it? This definitely feels like one of those moments in Salot Saar's story where we go, ah, okay, this is something. Not exactly a turning point, but something that we may be able to look at and determine as an eventual influence. These more definitive turning points, they are approaching, however, and one presents itself not long after Saar returns from his summer break in Yugoslavia. Now, it may be a fairly mundane beginning to it, but it's something that a lot of us can relate to. It's a stressful time. Basically, Prince Somonapong, the guy that had taken Saar under his wing slightly and arranged a place for him to stay in that first year in Paris, well, he had completed his studies at the end of the previous semester. He was heading back to Cambodia. This left Saar with nowhere to live. It's at this point that he reconnects with Yang Sari, who had maintained his political activities with the Democrats before also heading to Paris to continue his tertiary education. In fact, it may have been due to Sari's involvement in a student strike back in Phnom Penh that he received the scholarship to come to Paris, with the democratic officials at the head of the Ministry of Education deciding who would get them and happily approving of his role in the demonstration. So he is at this point one of those university students that is right into politics and activism, I guess we could say, and he was also bringing with him that influence of Marxism, having become familiar with the Communist Manifesto prior to his move to Paris. One of Sari's first moves upon arriving was to look up his old student mentor from the Lycée Sissawat, a Cambodian by the name of Keng Van Sak. He was a little older than the new arrivals to Paris and had been studying Cambodian linguistics. Van Sak was a prominent member of this group of Khmer students who had been in Paris since 1946. Another one of these, what would you call them, like young elders of the students living there, was a man named Tion Mum. He was a member of the most powerful non-royal family in Phnom Penh, and he, like Van Sak, was highly intelligent. Mum went on to become the first Cambodian to attend the Polytechnique, apparently the most prestigious of the French universities, which Philip Short describes as kind of like getting a first at Oxford or summa cum laude at Harvard. Both these guys will feature in our story quite a bit, but for now it's more important just to get across, well, in my eyes at least, this idea of a student group of Cambodians who have carved out a little society for themselves in Paris. You might have had a similar experience in your life if you've ever moved to a new city or made some large-scale upheaval, and you might tend to gravitate toward people that perhaps you knew back in your hometown or friends of friends that maybe made the same move, or there's perhaps a group of expats living abroad. But Tion Mum and Keng Van Sak kind of represent that for me. Like, they would have seemed that bit older, wiser, and more attuned to the conditions in Paris, and seem to have played that role of mentor in some vague fashion. It's Sari. Once he arrives, he goes to get in touch with Van Sak, as they had this close relationship back in Phnom Penh. He helps him settle in, and it is at this point that Sari mentions that one of his friends was desperately looking for a place to live. Van Sak, who was soon introduced to Salad Sar, he was in a position to help out. He arranged for the young man to move into a room above a wine shop, which doubled as a cafe. It was on the corner of the Rue du Commerce and Rue Letellier. Now, a quick look on Google Maps, and I feel like the building might still be the same one. Might be an optometrist's or a clothes shop. It's kind of hard to say which corner shop was the one on this four-way street. But anyway, the room itself back then was pretty dodgy, the bed being the only item of furniture provided. But when you are looking for a place to stay, soon enough, literally anything becomes a perfect fit, doesn't it? Anyway, Saar moved in straight away, and Van Sak seems to have taken quite a liking to him, as most did, and he lent him a chair and some pots and pans. His wife, a French woman named Suzanne, even came to help Saar as he suffered from flu over the winter. Van Sak strikes me as kind of an eccentric genius, a genuine intellectual, but someone who had lots of ideas about lots of different things. He was drawn to the left side of the political spectrum, but he was also fiercely nationalist and anti-royal. He was the kind of guy reciting poetry at Cambodian student parties, but also spent time developing theories about the original Khmer history and how it may have been corrupted by outside influences like Theravada Buddhism. He will go on to invent the Khmer typewriter as well. You know, he's just one of those guys. He will end up becoming a kind of mentor for Tsar, particularly after Van Sak and Tiong Mum are elected to a kind of leadership within the Khmer Student Association in Paris. And soon after that, they begin hosting informal kinds of discussion groups, known as Cercle d'Etude, or study circles. There was one for fine arts, literature, women's issues, and more. But it was a few weeks after these inaugural study circles were held that Van Sack invited a few friends to a more exclusive, unpublicized meeting at his apartment. Now, this group was concerned with political issues, particularly those affecting Cambodia. They would gather a few times a month, and this was during the time that Cambodia started to become properly embroiled in the now escalating war between the Viet Minh and the French. These students in Paris represented an intellectual and even societal elite that would have no doubt began assuming they would actually have a role to play in the coming years. I mean, students of a certain age may tend to overestimate their importance and presume their level of understanding of these events maybe more than what mapped onto reality. I mean, I certainly know I thought I knew much more than I did at that age. But the relevance to the story is that we have the beginnings of a student organization that was beginning to decide which direction they believed would be best for the country. They wanted independence for sure, but the influence of communism on the outcome would become stronger as the conflict in Indochina morphed from the colonial war that it had started as and started being framed as a Cold War theater. Salot Sar had become part of something that would mark the beginning of his journey toward communism. We could even call it the first stages of development for a vanguard revolutionary party. He was invited to these early study sessions, not so much out of his political acumen, but simply because of his association with Van Sack and Sari. Again, it seems that he was just coasting along into another environment that is going to have great consequence on his life. The study circles had begun by the end of 1950, a year where American foreign policy had well and truly become obsessed with containment and domino theories, where Moscow and China had recognized Ho Chi Minh's regime and begun arming them accordingly, while the US and her allies, they had recognized Cambodia, Laos, and what would soon become known as South Vietnam, while the Indochinese Communist Party had embraced the idea that getting rid of the French would necessitate revolutionary movements not only in Vietnam, but also in the other colonized states of Indochina. By 1950, the cold foreign winds and the warm, moist air of Cambodia had formed into this hurricane of history, being fed by developments from all around the world and beginning to look increasingly deadly. In part two, Indochina will be firmly in the middle of a war, and it is against that backdrop that we will explain Salot Sar's path toward communism, Sihanouk's crusade for independence, the entanglement of Vietnamese interests and revolution in Cambodia, as well as the end of the First Indochina War and the development of the Cold War in Southeast Asia. Until then, thank you again for listening.